Okay, we're going to go ahead and begin with Sundays with the Modern. Thank you so much for coming today. If any of you are new to this program, it happens every Sunday, 1 o'clock. We have somebody come in with a particular special informed point of view to talk about either the collection, the architecture, or the special exhibition. And next week, for example, if you come, Annette Lawrence will be here to talk about the Vernon Fisher exhibition. This exhibition, for obvious reasons, has gotten a lot of attention with this program. So we've had a lot of really interesting, we were just saying, highly unique, different tours each week that people have talked about the Vernon Fisher Show. Today, Dr. Francis Culpit, the D.D. Potter Rose Chair of Art History at TCU. Are you hearing me okay, everybody? Okay, good. Francis Culpit, the D.D. Potter Rose Chair of Art History at TCU, who has a BFA in painting and an MA in humanities from the University of Tulsa and a PhD in art history from the University of Southern California. She's here, obviously, to take us through the Vernon Fisher Show. Just to give you a little more information on Fran, she taught at the University of Texas in San Antonio, where you were the department chair.
Just for 3 years.
For 3 years. That's a long time
that
to be a department
chair. Yeah,
absolutely. She's also taught at Cornell University, the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the University of Southern California before coming to TCU. And I was trying to remember the year. What year was it, Fran?
2005.
Mm-hmm. Fran is here, of course, to take us through Vernon Fisher, Kmart Conceptualism, our special exhibition, for which the monograph, Vernon Fisher, that I hope you've seen in the bookstore, which was recently published by UT Press, has a very thoughtful and scholarly essay by Fran Culpit, was in some large part, I think, the impetus for this exhibition. Fran's credentials for today's tour are notable. She is a nationally recognized scholar of 20th century and contemporary art, an art historian, critic, and author of many books and essays on contemporary art, including Abstract Art in the Late 20th Century and Minimalism, the Critical Perspective, which is considered, just to note, a seminal text on the movement of minimalism. She is also a corresponding editor for Art in America, in addition to regularly writing for other publications, and she occasionally finds the time to curate with a number of very interesting exhibitions under her belt, including Material Culture, that I believe opened in 2007, 2008.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
And I know the publication came out in 2008, so I kind of made the assumption.
It must be 2007.
That's what I was thinking. And then currently, the exhibition Skin Freak, both of these exhibitions being at the Fort Worth Contemporary, one of the art galleries of TCU. So some of you may have seen those. And if you haven't seen Skin Freak, it has recently opened and is up through
1st of January? Something.
1st of January, so you still have time to get there. It's a great show. It's a painting show, and it's really interesting. And most specifically, I guess her qualifications for this come in that she offers a very unique and informed perspective on this exhibition, thanks to numerous conversations, studio visits, and I think it's fair to say debates that developed as she prepared her essay on Vernon Fisher. Some of you got to see them discuss, maybe even banter a little bit for Tuesday evening, so you know what I'm talking about. So with that, please join me in welcoming Frances Culpit.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is a good turnout. Great. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Some of you probably have read my essay in the book that Terry so kindly mentioned. The book is not the exhibition catalog, and I know there's been some confusion for people who think that it is the catalog, and it's not written like a catalog. It is a monograph that was... it wasn't even my idea. It was the University of Texas Press idea. So they came to me and asked me to go to Vernon to see if Vernon was willing to participate, and he was. And we spent a couple of years together And it was really enlightening. He says that he learned a lot from our conversation. However, I certainly learned, I think, more from him. I'm sure that he, you know, he recognized things in talking about it. He started making outlines, and I'd come to the studio at least once a week for a year, and I'd come to the studio and he'd have like 4 or 5 pages of outlines of, this is my idea on narrative, or this is my idea on memory. And just, so he was very, very organized and really seemed to understand his work perfectly, in fact. But if you've read my essay in the book, you know that I use Vernon as a sort of model postmodernist. And the reason that I came up with that thesis as kind of frame to look at Vernon's work is that I have felt still sort of lingering in the last few years a kind of hostility toward the whole concept of postmodernism. And there are a lot of people that sort of frown and don't want to accept that we've moved on and that we're in another period that's very, very different from the modern period. So I was kind of using the essay to talk about Vernon's work, but to also kind of introduce and maybe calm fears about postmodernism. One of the key tenets of postmodernism is the death of the author. The whole idea that the work of art is understood by the reader, and it's the reader who is the meaning maker, or the viewer in the case of visual art. We are the ones who give the work meaning, not Vernon. And it seems very, very perfectly sort of fit to his work, except that people persist in wanting to know why Vernon did this. What does this mean to Vernon? You know, why did he choose this instead of that? And I find myself going back and forth. As much as I believe in the fact that the meaning of the work is not made in the head of the artist or even on the canvas, but in my head, I still find myself, as I'm sure everybody does, resorting to, well, what did Vernon say? What did Vernon intend? You know, why did he choose this instead of that? So I thought today, as we walk through the exhibition, I would try to not talk about Vernon and not talk about his intentions. He's talked about it a lot. He's given 10 talks or something for this, a lot of exhibition talks. And as I said, after this long process of working with him, I think he really understands his work very well. But it would be interesting, I'm going to try to do that, in other words. I'm going to try to sort of talk about the work in context, but not necessarily in terms of his intention. One of the other things that connects his work, or doesn't connect it, but makes his work a model of postmodernism, is the fact that the meaning of the work, and it's very meaningful work, the meaning of the work is what the critic Roland Barthes calls writerly. That is, it's not readerly. You don't read the meaning in the work, but you sort of produce the meaning as you look at the work or as you take it apart, try to figure out what it's about. So it's what we call a writerly text. And it requires a lot of engagement. As you know, if you've walked through this exhibition, it's very often very frustrating. It's intended to be very frustrating because nothing comes to a close. You can't make a story make sense. Even if there's a written text in 84 Sparrows, for example, there's the written text on the camper scene in the middle, which starts out talking about blood splattering off down the wrist of the narrator and splashing off of his shoes, and then it shifts in the third paragraph to be talking about a little boy riding a merry-go-round. So there's always that kind of frustration where there's no closure, and it's very intentional on his part. There isn't a way, in other words, and you all probably know this, there isn't a way to take a work of art and determine its meaning, sort of to find a story with a beginning and a middle and an end. It doesn't work in that way, although it uses narrative as its primary structure. It won't tell a sensible kind of story. At the same time, this is something I'm always talking about to students about. When we say we're talking about a writerly text, or we're talking about the meaning being made by the viewer, it doesn't mean that the work of art can mean anything you want it to mean. And I've had so many arguments with students who say, well, if you said that it's in my responsibility to make the meaning, then I can make it mean whatever I want. There's still work. And the work has a material, physical, tangible, material existence. And so I always test my interpretation against what's in the work, so that it's not it's not completely made up in my head. Let's do walk through in here and look at 84 Sparrows, which I think is the kind of the beginning of Vernon's work, the beginning of his career.
He made a few multi-part pieces. Or no, this is the first multi-part piece, but he had made some text works, thank you, Terry, before this that included the sanded letters, where he uses plastic letters and they're sanded underneath the paper and then they're sanded through to give that sort of braille text. But this is the first work, I think, that was made with multi-parts, with three parts. And the text seems to me to be the central panel seems to me to be the linchpin. This is the axis from which this springs and that springs. And there are, everybody sort of knows, maybe I'm repeating what everybody knows about this, but there are there's a narrative thread that is established in the text that leads to and connects the birds and the image of Nancy and Aunt Fritzie on the right that has to do with what I would call atomization. That is, the blood is dripping down the wrist of the narrator, and we stress, and Vernon stresses this too, these are not autobiographical. He is not the one, although this may have happened to him. It's not about Vernon's wrist bleeding. It's about a narrator telling a story whose wrist is bleeding. So the blood drips down, it splashes off of his shoes. And that image, that visual image of the splatters, of the atomization, of this kind of fragmentation, is picked up by the birds, of course, the red splashes and the splatters of the fudge on the right. This was a cartoon panel from I think the early 60s by Ernie Bushmiller. The Nancy cartoon is a very famous cartoon strip. I don't think we still have this, but it was very famous. Cartoon strip that has always attracted artists because of the way Bushmiller draws, the simplicity of his drawing. And so you'll see lots of artists picking, not lots, but many artists have picked up on the Nancy cartoon strip. At any rate, the splashes of the blood, the splashes of the fudge, and the splashes of red paint on the birds ties the three things together and creates this narrative thread. Again, it's not a narrative that you can say, and so the conclusion is, but that links the three works. Something I just thought about this morning, I always return to this piece when I think about Vernon's work, something I just thought about this morning has to do with this trapezoidal shape that you see in several pieces. There's a parallelogram that's similar over there, and there are a couple of times that it reappears. There's the piece with the missile, I can't remember what the name of it is, but in the last room, of the piece that has the missile coming out of the water, there's also a trapezoidal shape. And that has a lot of implications. One of the significant ones, I think, for this, because this is a sort of originary piece for Vernon, it's a really important work in his overall career, also owned by this museum, which is a wonderful thing to have happened, is the idea of connection, not only through the narrative thread, but through formal structure. And the connection between the splashes of the paint and the splashes of the fudge, and the connection between the arc of the camper top, and this has been mentioned lots of times, and the arc of the soap, which this is a bar of soap that's been thrown in, extracurricular knowledge, from the window, and some people think it's a brick. It looks more like a brick than a bar of soap, but the rest of the comic strip specifies, you wouldn't know this, I think, unless you knew the comic strip or had heard from the artist, that there's a little boy throwing samples of free soap out on the sidewalk, and he threw one in the window, and so the soap has landed in the fudge, and they're all very, very surprised. But the trapezoid is not only a rectangle seen in perspective, so you have that kind of introduction of perspectival depth. It also derives from, and this is biographical information. I'm not sure that it is intentional information. I'm not sure that I want to refer to Vernon's intention, but part of his biographical information is that this is based on a bridge in Granbury that where Vernon grew up, with one of those old trestle bridges, I guess they're cast iron or steel trestle bridges, and he's left the trestle work here, which has the staples in it. Has everybody noticed that? Has Vernon talked a lot about that?
I've never heard that.
Oh. I hadn't even thought about it until this morning, and I was reading somebody's essay or an interview or something talking about the shape and the trestle work. It comes from this bridge over the Granbury River. And I don't know if I've ever seen it, but you, some of you probably have one, an old trestle bridge. So you can see the trestle work here. And that is picked up in some of the blackboard pieces with the trestle scaffolding behind them. You've seen, all seen that. That derives from this same bridge notion. And the idea that, and I, this may have been Vernon's idea that, it's not mine. The idea that it serves as a literary bridge. In other words, the implication of the bridge connects the three disparate sections of the work. So it functions as a kind of literary bridge, I guess, would be the idea of it. But you see that bridge in not only literally the trestle work in behind the blackboards, but the bridge in the whole exhibition. I just walked through the show again a few minutes ago. There's bridges that are built throughout the entire exhibition that have to do with imagery being repeated over and over and over again. So you'll see something in one gallery, a little floating vignette of mountains. There's a kind of reddish blue mountain range scene that appears in at least two pieces in this exhibition. You know, one sort of on the other side of that wall, I think, and then farther on in another room, you see that same mountain again. And so there are bridges that are built in our memory as we walk through the exhibition that may not even be conscious of. We may not even be conscious of them, but they connect the work. The whole idea of repeating an image from the stick chart map that's in the work over here to the stick chart map that's in the last room in that missile, the work with the missile, those repeating images and repeating forms appear again and again in his work. And one of the things that he's explained, again, I was going to try not to resort to Fisher, but one of the things that he's explained about the use of various images that come from what he calls his archive, and he has for decades collected reproductions in books and magazines and newspapers that he relies on, and snapshots of his own as well that are all filed away, that those images are like words for, he uses them like words. And he says a writer wouldn't have a problem using the word the, you know, in two different sentences. And the same way, I don't have the problem using the same landscape in two different artworks. So they function in a syntactical way as a contextualized meaning depending on the syntax and depending on the other images in the piece. So you can even think about 84 Sparrows as a sentence that reads left to right, although as I say, it makes more sense to start with the hinge in the center and then sort of bridge out to the sides. But the rearrangement of the parts, or the rearrangement or reuse of the parts, is like the reuse of words in a sentence. And once a writer's used a word, he doesn't just put that word away and never use that again. So that kind of structure of the bridge and the structure of repetition connects the work not only within individual pieces but within the exhibition as a whole. Let's look at this stick chart navigation, I think is the name of this piece, which is obviously related to 84 Sparrows in terms of its tripartite structure, the use in this case of a parallelogram rather than the trapezoid, referencing the bridge. This is, I think, perhaps even easier to kind of to identify the narrative thread than 84 Sparrows is. And the narrative thread is often in his work not simply the narrative thread is not simply conceptual. It can be formal as well. In this case, the narrative thread is mapping or navigation that ties the three seemingly disparate elements together. The the central text, the narrative text, and I think the work, it appears to begin with the story. And I'm not sure that that's always the case, but I think that it does, the story is the introduction to the piece, not only in the studio when he's making the work, but for us, that you've got to devote the 45 seconds or minute or whatever it takes to read the story, even though it's difficult to do. But the story in these early works is the seed for the development of the narrative thread. And the narrative thread here being navigation or mapping. The story tells about, it's a great little story about a man disappearing from his home for periods of time, and the wife doesn't know why he's gone, and he won't tell her where he's gone. And but she realizes when he comes back that all the radio buttons in the car radio are set to different radio stations. So to try to figure out where he went, she starts driving around the country, checking all the radio stations to find if she can find the place where they all line up and coincide with where. With how they're set, with where he has been. So there's this funny, kind of tender, sweet little story about, we don't know if she does, if she ever finds the place, you know, there's no conclusion, but this nice little story. And then, of course, the stick chart map, which is an allusion to a map, kinds of maps that are made by Marshall Islanders in the South Pacific who make maps out of that look like this, apparently, and they carry them or did carry them on their boat, so they had to be fairly small and lightweight, with the wind currents detailed and the islands in the Pacific Ocean represented by the seashells. So there is a kind of pre-technological form of mapping, a technological form of mapping with the narrative text, and then I don't know about whether the swimming platform, the diving platform, has much to do with mapping, but it does have to do with movement, and then this completely, as far as I know, absurd parallelogram with a little chart of numbers that I suppose one could talk about. Maybe that's some sort of measurement. Form of measurement or a reference, maybe to the thing that surveyors use, that measuring stick whose name now escapes me, that is appears in several other different works. Does anybody know what that trapezoid, that parallelogram is? Well, I know. I know the shape is the shape of the diving platform, but do you know? Does anybody know what it's supposed to be? Yeah, that's. I can make nothing except absurdity of it, you know, and numbers, which would be a kind of charting or mapping or maybe a way of navigating. But I think it's kind of a ringer in there. Three elements in the work. He's made work with four discrete elements, but they're. I don't think there are any in this show that I can recall. The three elements complicate a narrative, and so that's why there are three in these. It balances well formally, but it also complicates a narrative. It throws a kind of ringer into the narrative. And a narrative, a story has to have at least two elements to be a story at all. So that you've got to have you can't have a story with one element. So a story starts with two, and then it's complicated, I think, in his work by three. Speaking about two elements, this is a work, according to the label, called Complementary Pairs. This is a fairly early blackboard piece that includes two of his devices that appear frequently in the work, the map and the globe, in this case, the globe and the blackboard, both of which are pedagogical instruments, are used in the classroom, which I think is very significant within this body of work. It has a pedagogical quality to it. The artist doesn't like to talk about that. He doesn't think that that's relevant at all, the fact that he was a very influential and important teacher at UNT for many decades. Whenever I mention that I think they're pedagogical and they refer to the classroom, he says, dismiss that. That's not part of what they're meaning at all, but I think they are. I think it is relevant to his notion of instruction and they're familiar to us. The blackboard and the map or the globe also serves as a way of attaching elements, disparate elements, in this case casts of teeth that came from a dentist's office, or the tooth, whatever they, where they make dentures. Casts of teeth are attached here to images of World War II soldiers marching through a swamp, seen from the back. We see lots of things from the back in his work. But the blackboard and the map allow the attachment of objects and images in a completely, in an otherwise nonsensical way. When you think of a realistic painting or photograph, you don't have teeth floating in the air, but you can be completely convinced of teeth being, I guess, or something being attached to a blackboard with no acknowledgement of gravity, no acknowledgement of real space. It just allows things. I make the analogy to map pins. You can pin a map, a pin on a map at any spot, regardless of gravity, regardless of, you know, whether you're what kind of a map it is. It can allow for a non-realistic juxtaposition of images. This is called complementary pairs, and it's not like the work called complementary pairs. In fact, I'm surprised that it's called complementary pairs, because that particular piece has only one globe and only one photographic image of the soldiers. He has, in this reiteration, it's very different. This reiteration added a second globe and added a second image. The grisaille image on the left is new. The original work from 85 or 86 didn't have the black and white image in it. It also had a lot more writing on the blackboard, and it had the continents very specifically outlined on the globe so that the soldiers appear to be marching into Africa. And I suppose it's very hard to locate where we are in terms of the globe, where our point of view is, and the globe on the left. Obviously, not obviously, but I'm assuming that the top is the north and we're looking, you know, down on the globe. And maybe Africa would be where the red soldiers are, but you can't tell, because the continents aren't all drawn in. So it had a much different appearance when it first was made. He's taken the title Complementary Pairs, which originally I think referred to the teeth, the pair, each set of teeth being a pair of teeth, the one complementing the other. When you bite down, you know, your teeth are supposed to match. They complement each other in that way, and they're actually, if you look on them, they're all numbered. All of the teeth are numbered by the denture maker, whoever made the molds here, so that they match, so that the top and the bottom didn't get separated and you get two different people's mouths referenced in the teeth. Those teeth, I think, were the complementary pairs. And then in the first few examples of this that he made, and these have to be made on site each time they're shown, they have to be completely redrawn, and the image has to be re-silk screened onto the blackboard or onto the black acrylic paint, which simulates a blackboard here. The whole thing has to be remade, and I think the doubling that the title references the pairing is reinforced by doubling the image and doubling the photographic image and doubling the globe. A lot of the imagery does come from World War II, which would have been during the artist's youth. And I have often wondered, seeing this show installed, often wondered what people, of course I didn't live through World War II either, but what really younger people who didn't even grow up with much discussion of World War II would think about this. And I'm thinking that they probably have the same response that I have and most people have. I suppose people who grew up, who were alive during World War II and conscious of what was going on in the world, have different memories than we do, but we all function from a memory bank, a storage bank that's created by images that we have encountered younger people less so than middle-aged people in terms of this particular the event of the war. But we can all place this because we've seen movies and we've seen newspapers and we've read books, and so we immediately identify the source, not the source, but we immediately identify the subject of the photographic image, which could have come from a newspaper, could have come from an encyclopedia, a variety of sources. Often the images start with photographing the television set, and then they're manipulated so much that they, I don't know about this, but they're manipulated to the point that you can't tell that they came off the TV set. But he has done a lot of work where he's just taken a snapshot of a picture. Like all the Tarzan imagery that you see comes from at least most of it comes from his from taking a picture of the television set, and then now taking that picture through the computer and degrading it and doing all kinds of things so that you can't tell the source of the image. So we all have a bank of imagery that we can rely on. And World War II, which appears again and again and again, is a particularly mythic event for most Americans, I think, because it's been the subject matter of so many movies. And from my point of view, I think of movies that glorify the war, and were the war has come to seem like, or did come in the 20th century, come to seem like the real symbolic triumph of America, and it functions that way as this mythic event. So you see it again and again in his works with references to soldiers and to there's Japanese warplanes being shot down into the oceans and boats sinking and all kinds of heroic mythic imagery in his in the work. Some critics have made a comparison. I'm not sure that I want to that I'm so interested in this, but some critics have made a comparison to his use of the teeth, the cast of the teeth, and Jasper Johns's plaster cast of body parts. And that is a kind of interesting connection, but it doesn't seem to go any place for me. I mean, it's a historical point of connection, and he was influenced by Jasper Johns, but I'm not sure that that helps me understand what the teeth are doing there. And I think it's another example of that kind of ringer that looks kind of looks really good, looks very tactily seductive. I think it adds a material quality to the otherwise disembodied imagery of the drawing and of the photograph that's attractive and seductive. But I don't see any necessary connection between the drawing and the drawing and the teeth. So it's an open-ended narrative, other than the titular reference to the pairs, the complementary pairs. Does anybody have any thoughts about this work that you can share with me?
I do. I disagree with the teeth in this section of rings. I think that they're the actual union of the work.
How so?
Well, this one, for example, I think this refers to death.
Death?
Death.
Oh, death, yeah. Okay.
So the death of horses, so there's obviously a lateral.
Right. Would it be could it be that measuring rod that the surveyor used?
Yeah.
Which would be height, yeah.
I think that he's clearly interested in metaphysical poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanism to these things, when you've got the lateral mapping, you've got the spectacular, you've got depth, so it's giving you three dimensions. In this way, this refers to time as well, automatically, because
So you think the stick chart map is referring to verticality? Verticality?
No,
oh, okay. The map going this way. Okay.
Skeletons. Well, is that a skeletal?
Yeah. But these are cast for dentures, aren't they? Yeah.
They're still referring to teeth. They're not natural teeth. So, you know, you're talking about there's a journey going into Africa and this notion of backward into the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming out of the darkness, the heart of darkness, or whatever, is, mm-hmm. is white teeth. I don't think it's a great thing. It's a very specific psychological imperative advice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that every single piece he makes turns on a similar conceit. And that's what he talks about, metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's my writing.
Yeah. That's good. That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
In the image, you see the component numbers 1, 2, and the sharing processor. And to me, it looks like somebody is using a mock or some of the tools in 1 to chip away at some type of an object.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of is connected almost to the dentures, in that when the doctor is making a denture, they sometimes have to chip away.
Yeah, that's really great. Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense too. There are lots of connections. I don't see any specific connection to the teeth, although I understand what you're saying. I didn't think of death at all in looking at the teeth. I understand what you're saying, but it didn't occur to me that was about death. I kind of wish that Africa had been a little bit more clear, clearly outlined, that I didn't have to refer to another work to know that the soldiers were marching into Africa. So I'm not really sure that makes this piece really interesting, because I'm not sure if they are marching into Africa, because you can't tell what they're marching into. They're doubled and seen from some behind. Let's see here. Were you going to say something, Matthew?
Oh, I was just going to say that I think that's taking a grid of tension.
Yeah.
I mean, that's which indicates like these soldiers going into a dark place, and then it's this almost cinematic device where they would have this, like a close up of someone's teeth kind of gritting or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is probably just looking at this thing where it says Adriatic on the left, or just part of it. And he kind of, because he's building up something and adding something and then producing something so often, I think he lets these slippages come in. But when I looked at this piece a lot, even though it's not A-T-T-I-C, I thought of like an attic being a sort of dark place. And you see the word P-E, which could be something that indicates something physical, so like something physical happening in a dark place, which he allows those kind of subconscious slippages.
Right. That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of this as being, I guess I'm more in line with your interpretation of it, rather than being frightening or fearful or about death or something. That's an interesting read. It's different than I would have thought.
When I first looked at it, though, I noticed that all the dentures are different.
Yeah.
Dentures.
Right.
And seeing the different people, so I did make a connection between those things, thinking there was individual soldiers going into war, and that there was maybe some connection.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
There's also all kinds of information that we're not addressing that's, very faint, like something written at the top. And it seems to me with this piece, or maybe that's the case in a lot of Ernest's work, that you're given permission in a way, because he's sort of so overwhelmed you with possibility, you're given permission to actually dismiss them. Because there are things that are there in different degrees of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
So,
That is interesting. You're right. I mean, there's just too much in a work like this that you can't take, and it doesn't all fit together. You can try to force it all together, but it won't all fit together. I was talking to him the other day about David Sally. And did I tell you the story about him? He and David Sally are Sally's a little bit younger, but they got well known at the same time in the early 80s, and both were associated with neo-expressionism. Sally with a more conceptual version of it, and Fisher with a movement called narrative art in the early 70s. But they were shown together a lot, and their works both have this kind of inconclusive narrative quality, where there's in Sally's work there's overlaying of images, and they won't come together. It has that same kind of frustrating. You can't pull them together. You can't make sense of it unless it's an arbitrary. You can make up a story that's arbitrary. And I guess I was, maybe the backdrop is that I was giving a lecture on Sally and Fisher in the same class, And then I was with Vernon right after that and mentioned something about having talked about his work and David Sally's, and he said, yeah, we showed together so much and there are so many things in common, but here's the difference. Like he said, I just thought about the difference between my work and David Sally's. Sally is not invested in anything in his paintings. They all have the same, here's an image, there's an image, that no image is more important than any other, which is right. I mean, that's right. They're non-hierarchical in that there's no real figure and ground, and the figure's more important than the ground. There's no sort of central image that is more important than peripheral images. And Fisher said about his work, I'm invested in everything. And I thought that was really insightful, that even the little erasures, the tiniest little thing, he said he takes a painting to the point where he thinks if he puts one more drop of paint on it, it's going to ruin it, and he does it. You know, that he is just so invested in each little area. But we can't be. I can't be. I can't. I can try to decipher the writing. I've tried to look at even, you know, reproductions. I'll get my magnifying glass out and pour over this thing and try to decipher the erasures, and that you can't do it. You know, they're not really meant to be.
But you always feel like you can. You always feel like you're failing the painting a little bit when you walk away.
And you do. And that's the very same feeling about the overall narrative, right? Is that you can't. You want to, what does he call that? Rationalization or something. There's a term that you want to make everything make sense. And it's just part of our psychology that we want to create a story out of everything. And he intentionally works against that. He intentionally makes it so that it won't close. We can't make the story make sense, which is really frustrating.
And you understand how they all fit together, but then it puts us all on the floor. When you try to understand something, you destroy it. You don't necessarily destroy it, but you change its form. And it seems to me that's what Vernon is all about. Mm-hmm. You can't not have something that builds its thing through the rose pipe and allows us to get through it. And of course, by the time you get through it, you learn something, but not the thing, because the thing
has been altered.
Right, it always does. Yeah. Right. I wonder, though, if the theme of a metaphysical poem is the same as the narrative thread, is equivalent to a narrative thread in his... Okay, now what? Let's see. Let's go look at these. The Raw and the Cooked, and Out of Africa, and My Private Africa. Do you know, I think I'll sit on that stool. Thank you. Is this okay to do
this?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? I'm surprised you haven't done it.
No. I think, if you don't mind if I sit down, I think that everybody has favorite Fishers, and these three are among my very, very favorites, and so I was really pleased to see them installed together so closely that you can make visual comparisons between them. These two have to do, of course, with the Africa theme that has been running through his work for quite a while, at least in the 2000s. I don't think there are any in the 90s, but the Africa map appears in there are, because this is 95, so I guess there are some in the 90s. This may be the first African map. Again, it's owned by the Modern Art Museum, which is another wonderful choice. In case you don't know, their collection was also enhanced by the inclusion of the Coriolis effect, which is the one with the twigs coming out of it, you know, in the green. That was Vernon's gift to the museum recently. So that's just, it's wonderful to have those three. There's only
I think they might be. 84, Sparrows, and Private Africa, and that one now. Do you have a print? Those three are so wonderful to get. I mean, they're really, it's really great that Fisher has, that they've either bought or he has given his hometown museum three very, very important examples of his work, and I'm sure he'll keep working and keep giving, hopefully. So the African map appears in Private Africa early on. This may be the first Africa one. The map is, the same map appears again and again, different iterations of it, using different stencils, different typeface, and so forth, but it's always this central African with the Congo in the middle, and not all of Africa shown, a focus on the central part of Africa. The maps that he uses for the African series are 19th century colonial maps. They're not current maps, as you probably know. It'd be hard to get a current map of Africa. It keeps changing it's the names all the time. But the use of the colonial map is a reference to colonial Africa and to the fact that Africa was divided up by the Europeans in the 19th century, primarily for the purposes of ivory hunting. And that is very beautifully articulated by Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is a novel that's central to a lot of the Africa, well, I guess it's central to all of the Africa works. And I went back and read it a couple of years ago as I was working on the book, and it loved it. It had been so long since I'd read it. It was really very frightening, and it's worth reading again and thinking about Vernon's painting sort of as visualizations of that really horrific horrific time. So the 19th century map refers to colonial Africa. The title, My Private Africa, redoubles that, talking about the privatization of Africa, which is also suggested. Privatization and colonization is also suggested in Man Cutting Globe, where it's a literal illustration of dividing up the earth, right, in 19th century and earlier colonialism by the Europeans primarily. So Private Africa refers to that. There's also a biographical reference for Private Africa. And again, this is another one where it's interesting to know, you know, that that's the Granbury Bridge in 84 Sparrows. But I'm not sure, other than the idea of the bridge, which is crucial, but the fact that he grew up playing under the bridge is important to the work, or important to us. The title refers to his growing up, also his youth, and his parents, his mother's church. His family was divided. He said they come from a mixed family or something like that. One was Methodist and the other was Baptist. It's very Texan, isn't it? And his Baptist mother made him go to church all the time, and they would have missionaries come and report on their, you know, the missionaries in Africa. And so that title of Private Africa is, it's a, you know, biographical reference to the fact that it was, it, you know, refers to his childhood and his memories of Africa, his memories of slides of Africa shown by missionaries. There are sort of interesting connotations in the use of the African map and some of the more stereotypical African imagery that I haven't solved. I think they're worth acknowledging the interest, the issues of ethnicity and race that are obviously raised by the work. I haven't solved it. I don't know exactly where to go with that, other than to acknowledge that those kinds of references are there. I just haven't brought it all together in my mind. Maybe I will someday. So that's My Private Africa includes this central map with the images overlaid of the waterfall. There's a reference to Victoria Falls in one of the captions on the map, and the vignette of the parachuter falling and swimming and diving and parachuting, and all of those images of movement appear again and again in the work. A good example of the anti-autobiographical quality, despite the fact that the title refers to his, you know, growing up in the church, that which has very little to do with the painting, is the fact that all this swimming, all this water stuff that appears again and again, caused me once to ask him if
he likes to swim, and he said, no, I don't care anything about swimming. It doesn't interest me at all. And you would think, for somebody that used all these images of swimming and water, that it would be something that he cared about, but he cares nothing about it. He said, I don't know if that's true, but he told me that he didn't care anything about swimming. So swimming has a metaphorical quality of movement through space or through water, movement from one thing to the next, and frequently is referenced in the Africa paintings with Tarzan, who was there are several images of Tarzan, Johnny Weissmuller, I guess, swimming in the painting. So that brings that together. The Tarzan is also the source of the disparate images in Out of Africa. The picture of Harry Parker in the pith helmet is seen with, I think those are both the same guy in the upper right hand corner, I'm not sure, but on the left, the two great white hunters, you've always put quotation marks around those terms, those words, the two great white hunters are Harry Parker, who was the father of Jane in the Tarzan movies, and his partner, who had gone to Africa, as you know, taking, if you've seen Tarzan, they take Jane, the daughter, with them to Africa, and then she meets Tarzan, and all hell breaks loose after that. But those are the two pith-helmeted figures. And then there are different images of the apes and the chimpanzees from varieties of sources that seem to be, in many cases, dissolving on the map. This is the result of putting the scanning a photograph and then running it through a computer and enlarging the pixels so that it begins to appear to disintegrate. The process, if most of you don't know about how these things are made, the newer works like this, is a lot of it's done on the computer. The vignettes are hand painted. Like the red monkeys are done with stencils, but the vignette of the blow up advertisement of the gorilla, which is that on that or was on that, there was a haunted house. Do you remember this on I-30? Just before TCU, you guys remember that? It had a blow-up ape on it. That's what that is. That was derived from a snapshot that he took of that big monkey. And those are hand-painted, very carefully done, as you can probably see. Skillful. He's an amazingly skillful depictor, renderer. And then the map and the red, in this case, the red and the black images, the pixelated images, derived from scanning. A photograph is scanned into the computer and then it's run through Photoshop and the pixels are enlarged so that it begins to break down into these pixelated kind of images. His computer is connected to a stencil cutter, a vinyl stencil cutter, which is sort of like a printer that it will cut. They're amazing machines, I think, that will cut really minute vinyl stencils that are like, we used to call it letraset, vinyl letters. You know what those things are? They're sticky on the back, and that you can do signage with them. You guys know what that is. It comes out in sheets, big wide sheets that'll shoot out of this stencil cutter, and then the stencil hole, just this big piece of plastic, of vinyl, is stuck on the surface of the canvas, and then peeled away so that where the red letters are and the red lines, the longitude and latitude and the text and all those captions are negative spaces in the stencil. And then he paints with an airbrush or with a paintbrush, paints over top of it, and then you pull off the whole stencil. So you get this, he's an amazing stenciler. You get this really precise crispness with the use of the vinyl cut stencils. Some of you may know Jeff Elrod's work. Do any of you know Jeff Elrod? He shows at Dun & Brown and was in a Focus show last year. Was it last year? A couple years ago. He was one of Vernon's students and also uses that same process for his abstract work. So he puts it to a very different purpose, but uses that same vinyl cutter, that same kind of machine that Fisher uses in his work. This is, I think, a really great African painting of Fisher's because it references on so many levels all of the mythology. I was talking about the mythology of World War II with complementary pairs. All of the mythology of Africa from our point of view, from a Western point of view, and that, I think, the fact that it is from a Western point of view that doesn't take any into consideration anything about the African point of view, which obviously Vernon doesn't really have access to, but that's an interesting point in itself. All of this information is received. So we have the blow-up Godzilla, which is a sort of a scary movie monster ape type thing, also referencing the giant King Kong, another, it's like Heart of Darkness, another mythology of, materializing our fears of the unknown of Africa. And if you've read Heart of Darkness, you know that it gets more and more frightening the farther you get in the book and the farther that Marlowe gets into the heart of Africa. You can really sense that it's getting darker and more frightening and as he's going towards the unknown. And that is referenced here, plus the kind of gorilla mask that gray monkey seems to have, or gray, whatever that is, ape, almost seems to be a Halloween mask. The title Out of Africa refers, of course, to the novel by the novelist Karen somebody. Does anybody know Bixen? Is that her name? I don't remember. Yeah, that's all I knew. I know, too. But there was a 1937 novel, I think, that was you know what it is? Oh, it is? I thought it was a woman named Karen Blixen or something. But we all know the movie, right? That was based on maybe memoir, maybe not a novel, maybe a memoir. So there's that, and then there's Heart of Darkness, the novel of Conrad, and then all the fictionalizations like the Tarzan movies, the King Kong movies, Godzilla movies, and so forth. So all of those ways in which the other of Africa have been manifested in Western culture seem to be referenced in this work at the same time with a great sense of humor. I think it's a kind of a funny work as well. And then the raw and the cooked is also uses that vinyl stencil process. A lot of his works do take advantage of that, and it's just technically looking at this thing is pretty amazing. The graph paper is a stencil, was made with a stencil, so that it, you know, I guess he scanned a piece of graph paper. I'm not sure exactly what the source was, but the graph paper background was scanned, and then it prints out as a stencil, so that each little square has to be pulled off, right, and leaving just those tiny little lines between the vinyl stencil, which is then painted, and then the rest of the stencil is pulled off to produce what almost looks like very illusionistically convincing graph paper. The brand or the logo down here, which says F plus T, 24 by 24 to the foot, fiche and tattoo, is also fake. This is a reference to four alter egos that were illustrated in an installation piece he did in 1991 called Hills Like White Elephants. And the very last room of this show with the raccoon and the branch and the black cross were also part of that show, in which he showed it in Sacramento, and it was shown in at Barry Whistler in Dallas and another place, several places. It traveled, it changed, as he is wont to do from place to place. But Fish and Tattoo are two of the fictional characters that represent alter egos. Werner Fish is he made all these people up. Werner Fish is supposed to be the Anselm Kiefer, the tortured romantic poetic soul, and Consuela Tattoo is it's a Consuela, I think, is the name that he made up, and I keep thinking that is a girl's name, but anyway, it's supposed to be a man. Consuela Tattoo has a sense of humor, and he or she, whichever one it is, does sort of funny things when that person gets to exhibit. There are two other characters that were in that show whose names elude me now, but they represented types of artists. So they were each a different type of artist, and these were aspects of I don't want to say of his personality, but aspects that an artist could be, you know, myths, mythological types, I guess, that one can choose. One can choose to be, or maybe you can't help it if you're the romantic, expressive type, but there are different kinds of artists, and so these artists were sort of separated out in this exhibition and given different responsibilities. And the show, Hills Like White Elephants, actually didn't, I think Fisher was in it, but they were all works by him, but apparently people didn't know that, and they actually thought it was a group show when they went to the exhibition. I saw it in 1991 in Dallas, but I must have known ahead of time because it didn't surprise me. I knew that it was all Vernon Fisher, but he had these different names. But apparently not everybody knew that, and they thought it was a group show because the work was so different. I think that exhibition, which is crucial in his work, Hills Like White Elephants, as a concept, I think that is another kind of justification for the concept of the death of the author not having any singular, personal, enduring identity that is expressing itself in art, that it is, you know, in an existential or sort of post-structuralist way, it's the work that makes the man rather than the man that makes the work. So it's through the work that we know who Vernon Fisher is. I mean, some of us know him personally, but we don't know him personally through the work. We know a Vernon Fisher person, an artist named Vernon Fisher, through our understanding and appreciation and thinking about the work. Okay. Oh, so this one. Am I done? Oh, I'm done. Oh, my God. We didn't get very far. Yeah, so I don't want to keep you all any longer. So that's all I have to say, unless anybody has any questions.
Do you know who those two characters are, the one with the cigar and then the man in the black bottom?
They're cartoon characters. I don't know who they are. This guy I recognize from 1940s, don't you? From 1940s cartoons. Do you know who it is? He could be found. I don't know what his name is. He's a cigar-chomping cartoon character. I mean, like a comic strip. I don't think he was a moving animated cartoon. I think it was a comic strip character. But this is a Raphael self-portrait, of course. And those are Harry Parker. You know, father of Jane and Fred Astaire and so forth. This is a great example of this process that he uses. That's called the meta. The metonymic slide, that each of these are metonyms. And metonyms are like metaphors, except metonyms are about doing and metaphors are about being. And one portrait will kind of lead to the next. One thing is chosen. I'm betting that the Raphael portrait was the first thing that was chosen, and then that leads to this, which leads to that. There's Johnny Weissmuller and Tarzan up there at the top left there, which might lead to a chimpanzee suggesting cheetah and Harry Parker. So there's a lot of Tarzan references in this painting as well, but one image leads to the next rather than everything being planned out at once. Anybody else have any other questions? Oh, isn't that funny? It looks exactly like her paintings. I never noticed that before. I never thought about that before. I don't know what I make of that at all. I don't know. Does anybody know? Do you think it's a reference to Julie's work? Terry?
I'm sorry.
Is this a reference to Julie's work?
I've never heard that.
Okay. It does. Had you thought about it? No. Yeah, hers is flat on, I believe. I think so. But that's a really interesting point. I don't know. I don't know. I can't answer that. It's a mysterious landscape. It looks like an industrial landscape, doesn't it? Urban landscape rather than what one would expect with the Tarzan references being a jungle landscape. So it seems like a contrast to me. And I'm not sure who those two cartoon characters are otherwise. Anything else? I usually can't answer it, but. Thank you. Thank you.
Getting to this point, the kind of intense looking at was good because we kind of moved all the way through.
Oh, you have. Okay. The only thing I would really like to go, I don't want to do it, but I mean, was a Boat Island Ape, which I think is a really important piece. Don't you guys? Boat Island Ape with the letters Kong cut out of the wall. That's really amazing. That seems to kind of summarize everything from the cartoon noises getting, you know, there's all the, in Jocko at Dover, there's all those images of Sluggo and Nancy getting bricks hit on their head, you know, and stars flying out. And that's the soundtrack for those, for that piece. And that to me is like, that blew my mind when I saw that in this show. That just did it for me. That was really great. Yeah, yeah. We don't call it Kong.
No, we don't.
We got in trouble for calling it Kong. Right. Thank you, Terry. Thank you all. Thanks for sticking with me. Well, good. I can't believe it. Have you heard all of them? All the talk?